One ought instead to court the superior, adorn the inferior, and honor the equal, and to greet and love them all, on the ground that they have become friends not through the dinner table or the wine cup or the hearth, but through a common and public vote, and in a sense possess, as an inheritance from their fatherland, this goodwill toward one another. Scipio, at any rate, got a bad name at Rome because, when he was entertaining friends at the dedication of the Temple of Hercules, he did not invite his colleague in office, Mummius. For even if in other respects they did not consider themselves friends, in matters of this sort they thought it right to honor and show courtesy on account of the office. Since then, so small a lapse of kindness brought a reputation for arrogance upon a man otherwise as admirable as Scipio. Surely anyone who diminishes the dignity of a colleague in office, or maligns his ambitious undertakings, or, in short, appropriates everything to himself out of self-will while stripping his colleague of it, could hardly appear reasonable and moderate. I remember that when I myself was still young and had been sent as an envoy along with another man to the proconsul, and my colleague had somehow been left behind, so that I alone met with him and transacted the business, when I was about to return and report on the embassy, my father stood up and told me privately not to say, "I went, but we went," and not, "I said, but we said," and in general to associate my colleague with the report and share the credit in giving my account. For such conduct is not only fair and humane, but it also removes the envy that causes pain from one's reputation. This is why great men attribute their successes to a divine power or to fortune as well, as Timoleon, who put down the tyrannies in Sicily, founded a shrine to Automatia. And Pytho, admired and honored by the Athenians for killing Codes, said, "God did this, using my hand." And Theopompus, the king of the Lacedaemonians, said to the man who claimed that Sparta was kept safe because its kings knew how to rule, rather because the people know how to obey. Now both of these things come about through each other. Most people say and believe that it is the work of political education to produce citizens who are governed well. For in every city the governed body is greater than the governing one, and each man rules for only a short time, while he is governed for his whole life as a participant in a democracy. So it is the finest and most useful lesson to obey those in authority, even if they happen to be inferior in power and reputation. For it is absurd that the leading actor in tragedy, a Theodorus or a Polus, though a hired performer, should often follow and address humbly the man who speaks the third-rate parts, if that man wears the diadem and holds the scepter, while in real actions and in political life, the rich and famous man should slight and despise a magistrate who is a private citizen and a poor man, insulting and undermining, by his own personal standing, the dignity of the city. Rather than increasing and adding his own reputation and power to that of the office. Just as in Sparta both the kings rose up before the ephors, and any other citizen who was summoned did not obey by walking but ran, displaying his ready obedience to the citizens through the marketplace at a run and in haste, taking pride in honoring the magistrates, not like some tasteless and boorish people who, priding themselves as it were on a surplus of their own strength, abuse umpires at the games and revile corresponsors at the Dionysia and mock generals and gymnasiarchs. Not knowing or realizing that honoring others is often more glorious than being honored oneself. For a man of great power in the city, a magistrate who serves as his bodyguard and escort brings him greater distinction than one who himself serves as bodyguard and escort to another. Rather, the latter brings unpleasantness and envy, while the former brings true glory, the glory that comes from goodwill. A man seen at another's doors, greeting him first sometime, and taking him by the arm in a walk, loses nothing of himself and confers adornment upon the city. It is also popular-minded to endure a magistrate's abuse or anger, or to quote the line of Diomedes, "For glory will follow this man too," or the saying of Demosthenes, that the man in question is now not merely Demosthenes, but also a lawgiver, or a corresponsor, or a crowned official. One should therefore put off retaliation to a later time, for either we will call him to account once he has left office, or we will gain by waiting for his anger to subside. Yet with zeal and forethought for the common good, and with concern for every office, one must always compete. If the officials are agreeable men, by guiding them in what needs doing, pointing it out, and letting them act on well-considered plans while contributing to the good repute of the community. But if there is some hesitation, delay, or ill nature among them regarding action, then he must be present in person and speak before the people, and not neglect or slacken his concern for public affairs on the ground that it is not fitting, since another holds office, to meddle and administer in his stead. For the law always gives the first rank in the Constitution to the man who does what is just and understands what is advantageous. There was a certain man, it says, in the army, Xenophon, who was neither general nor captain, but by understanding what needed to be done and daring to establish himself in a position of command, he saved the Greeks. And among the deeds of Philopoemen, the most famous is this. When Nabis had seized Messene and the general of the Achaeans was unwilling to help and shrank back in cowardice, Philopoemen himself set out with the most eager men, without a formal decree, and rescued the city. Yet one should not introduce innovations for trivial and chance reasons, but only in cases of necessity, as Philopoemen did, or for noble ends, as Epaminondas did when he extended his term as Boeotarch by 4 months beyond the law, during which he invaded Laconia and accomplished what he did concerning Messene. So that, if anyone should bring accusation or blame against him for this, the necessity of the act, or the greatness and nobility of the deed, might serve as a defense against the charge, or as consolation for the risk. They record a saying of Jason, the monarch of the Thessalians, which he used to repeat whenever he used force or gave someone trouble, that it is necessary for those who want to act justly in great matters to commit small injustices. Now this maxim one could immediately recognize as the language of a despot, but the following is a more statesmanlike precept: to yield small matters to the many, granting them as favors, in order to stand firm on greater matters and prevent them from going wrong. For the man who is excessively precise and severe about everything, yielding and giving way in nothing but always harsh and inexorable, accustoms the people to contend against him and grow resentful, when he might, by giving way a little like a foot yielding before the great force of a wave, indulge and play along in some matters, graciously, as at sacrifices, games, and theatrical shows, while in others pretending, as one does with the faults of the young in a household, not to see or hear. So that the power of admonishing and speaking frankly, like that of a medicine not worn out or stale, but still at its full strength and credibility, may take firmer hold and bite more deeply on the greater occasions. Alexander, for instance, on hearing that his sister had taken up with one of the handsome young men, was not angry, saying that she too should be allowed to enjoy some benefit from his kingship. Though in conceding such things he was not acting rightly, nor in a manner worthy of himself. For one must not regard the dissolution of authority and its abuse as the enjoyment of it. Toward the people, the true statesman will not permit, so far as he is able, any abuse against citizens, nor confiscation of others' property, nor distribution of public funds. But by persuading, teaching, and warning, he will fight against such desires as those who fed and increased the great drone with a sting that they created in the city around Cleon, as Plato says. But if the people, taking a traditional festival and the honor of a god as their occasion, set out toward some spectacle, or a light distribution, or some act of kindness, or a display meant to win favor, let them enjoy on such occasions the pleasure that comes both from freedom and from prosperity. Indeed, in the policies of Pericles and of Demetrius, there is much of this sort, and Cimon adorned the marketplace with plantings of plane trees and covered walks. And Cato, seeing the people stirred up by Caesar in the affair of Catiline and dangerously inclined toward a change of constitution, persuaded the Senate to vote distributions of money to the poor, and this gift put a stop to the disturbance and quelled the uprising. For just as a physician, after drawing off a great deal of corrupted blood, brings in a little harmless nourishment, so the statesman, after removing something great that was disgraceful or harmful, soothes the discontented and complaining spirit with a light and kindly favor in return. It is no bad thing, too, to redirect the people's zeal toward other useful objects, as Demades did when he had control of the city's revenues. For when the people were eager to send out triremes to help those revolting from Alexander, and were ordering him to supply the money, he said, "You have money. for I have made preparations for the Cho's festival, so that each of you may receive a half mina. But if you would rather have it for this purpose, use your own funds for it yourselves. And in this way, so that they should not be deprived of the distribution, they let the expedition drop, and he thereby dissolved the people's grievance against Alexander. For many things cannot be pushed away from unprofitable courses by a direct approach, but require some sort of roundabout turn and redirection, such as Phocion also used. When ordered to invade Boeotia at an inopportune time, he immediately proclaimed that all men from youth up to 60 years of age should follow him. And when the older men raised an outcry, he said, "What is so terrible? For I, your general, who am 80 years old, will be with you." In this same way, one must also cut off untimely embassies, by enrolling among their number many of those who are unsuited for the task, and useless building projects, by ordering that everyone contribute to them, and unseemly lawsuits, by requiring that people attend and travel abroad together for them. And those who propose and instigate such measures must be the first ones dragged in and made to take part. For either, by shrinking back, they will themselves seem to be dissolving the undertaking, or, by being present, they will share in its difficulties. Where, however, something great and useful needs to be accomplished, something that requires much contest and effort, there try to choose the best of your friends, or, among the best, the gentlest. For these will least oppose you and will most cooperate, since they possess good sense without love of contention. Furthermore, being experienced in one's own nature, one must, in matters where one is by nature weaker than another, choose those who are more capable rather than one's equals. As Diomes, for his reconnaissance mission, chose the prudent man to accompany him, passing over the brave ones. For undertakings are more evenly balanced, and rivalry does not arise between men who compete for honor on the basis of different virtues and abilities. So take on as a partner in a lawsuit, and as a companion in an embassy, if you are not capable of speaking, the man skilled in rhetoric, as Pelopidas took Epaminondas. And if you are unpersuasive in addressing the crowd and are lofty in manner, as Callicratidas was, take the man who is charming and attentive. And if you are weak and ill-suited for hard work in body, take the industrious and vigorous man, as Nicias took Lamachus. For in this way Geryon would have been enviable, with his many legs, hands, and eyes, if he had directed them all with a single soul. Statesmen have the privilege of combining not only bodies and money, but also fortunes and powers and virtues, if they are of one mind, into a single service, and thereby gain greater renown from another's contribution in the same undertaking. Unlike the Argonauts, who, having left Heracles behind, were forced, sung and drugged as they passed through the women's quarters, to save themselves and steal the fleece. Entering certain temples, men leave gold outside, but they bring in iron for practically nothing at all. Since the speaker's platform is a common shrine belonging alike to Zeus of the council, Zeus of the city, Themis, and Justice, from the very outset strip off love of wealth and love of money, like iron thick with rust and a disease of the soul, and cast it away into the marketplaces of shopkeepers and moneylenders. Keep yourself apart from it, holding that the man who profits from public funds is stealing from temples, from tombs, from friends, from perjured testimony, that he is an untrustworthy counselor, a perjured judge, a bribe-taking magistrate, in short, a man clean of no injustice whatsoever. Hence there is no need to say much more about this. But love of honor, though a more high-spirited vice than love of gain, brings no fewer disasters in political life. For boldness attaches to it even more, since it is engendered not in idle or lowly natures, but chiefly in vigorous and youthful ambitions, and that the swelling of crowds often joining in raising it up and pushing it along with their praises makes it uncontrollable and hard to manage. Just as Plato said that the young should be told, from childhood on, that it is not right for them to wear gold about themselves or to possess it, since they already have an inborn kind mingled in their soul, hinting, I think, at the virtue that runs down to their natures from their lineage, so let us console ambition, telling it that we have within ourselves gold uncorrupted and unmixed and unstained by envy and blame. An honor that grows together with the reasoning and the review of what we have done and administered in public life. For this reason, there is no need of honors painted, or molded, or wrought in bronze, in which even what is admired belongs to someone else. For it is not the man for whom the statue was made who is praised, but the one by whom it was made, as with the trumpeter and the bodyguard. And Cato, when Rome was already by then being filled up with statues, would not allow one to be made of himself, saying, I would rather have people asking why there is no statue of me than why there is one. For such things bring envy, and most people think that they owe gratitude to those who have not received honors, while regarding those who have received them as burdensome, as though they were demanding repayment for their services with interest. Just as the man who has sailed safely past the Cyades and then capsizes near the strait has accomplished nothing great or admirable, so too the man who has kept himself safe from the treasury and the public revenue office, but is then caught up over the front seat of honor or the prytaneum, has struck upon a lofty headland, but is submerged all the same. The best man, then, is the one who needs none of these things, but flees and declines them. But if it is not easy to reject some favor from the people and their goodwill flowing toward this end, then, since the contest of public life is, for those who compete in it, not one fought for silver or for gifts, but truly a sacred one and a crown contest, an inscription suffices, and a tablet, and a decree, and a branch of olive, as Epimenides took when he purified the city from the Acropolis. Anaxagoras, for his part, declined the honors offered him and asked instead that on the day of his death the children be let off from their lessons to play and have a holiday. To the seven Persians who killed the Magi, they and their descendants were given the privilege of wearing the tiara tilted forward over the legs joined to the head. For this, it seems, they made into a token as they went forth to the deed. There is also something civic in the honor paid to Pittacus. For of the land he had won, when the citizens told him to take as much as he wished, he took only as much as his javelin reached when he threw it. And the Roman cockles took only as much as he, lame as he was, could plow around in a single day. For the reward for such a deed ought not to be payment but a token of honor, so that it may endure a long time, just as those tokens endured. As for the 300 statues of Demetrius of Phalerum, not one of them gathered rust or grime, but all of them were taken down while he was still alive, and the statues of Demades were melted down into chamber pots. Many such honors have suffered this fate, not only because of the baseness of the recipient, but also because of the very greatness of what was given. Hence the finest and most secure safeguard of honor is modesty in its scale. While great, excessive, and weighty honors, like disproportionate statues, are quickly overturned. I speak now of the honors which most people, following Empedocles, do not call right, but which I too, by custom, call honor. Since the true honor and gratitude, founded in the goodwill and disposition of those who remember, a political man will not despise, nor will he scorn reputation by fleeing to please one's neighbors, as Democritus thought one should. For not even the affection of dogs or the goodwill of horses is something to be cast aside by hunters and horse breeders, but it is both useful and pleasant to work such a disposition toward oneself in creatures raised and familiar with us, of the kind that the dog of Lysimachus displayed, and that the poet describes concerning the horses of Achilles and Patroclus. And I think the bees too would do better if they were willing to greet and welcome those who feed and tend them rather than sting them and grow fierce. But as it is, people subdue the bees with smoke, and lead violent horses and runaway dogs, forced, with collars and bridles. But nothing except trust in goodwill, a reputation for honorable character, and a belief in justice can make one human being gentle and tractable toward another, willingly. And Demosthenes rightly declares that the greatest safeguard for cities against tyrants is distrust. For this, above all, is the part of the soul by which we are captured, the part in which we place our trust. Just as when Cassandra was held in no repute, her prophecy was of no use to the citizens, for she says, the God has set me to prophesy in vain, and among those who have suffered and lie in troubles I am called wise, but before they suffer I am thought mad. So too the trust placed in Archytas and the goodwill shown toward Battus greatly benefited those who made use of them, because of their reputation. And this is the first and greatest good inherent in the reputation of statesmen, the trust which grants entry to public action. Second, that the goodwill of the many serves as a weapon for good men against the envious and the wicked, as when a mother wards a fly from her child, when he lies in sweet sleep, warding off envy, and in relation to positions of power, leveling the low-born with the well-born, the poor with the rich, the private citizen with the rulers. And in general, whenever truth and virtue are added to it, it becomes a fruitful and steady wind behind a political career. Consider, by contrast, the opposite disposition, as you study it in the examples. The children and wife of Dionysius were prostituted and then killed by the people of Italy, who then burned their bodies and scattered the ashes from a ship over the sea. But when a certain Menander, who had ruled reasonably well in Bactria, died in camp, the cities held the rest of his funeral rites in common. But when it came to a contest over his remains, they only with difficulty came to an agreement, so that, dividing an equal share of the ashes among themselves, they went away, and there came to be memorials to the man among all of them. Again, the people of Acragas, once freed from Phalaris, voted that no one should wear a gray-blue cloak, because the tyrant's bodyguards wore gray-blue loincloths. And the Persians, because Cyrus had a hooked nose, even now are enamored of hooked noses and consider them the most beautiful. Thus the strongest, and at the same time most divine of all forms of love, is the one that cities and peoples come to feel toward a single man on account of his virtue. Whereas the falsely named honors that come from theaters, or distributions, or gladiatorial games, and their false witnesses, resemble the flatteries of courtesans toward crowds, always smiling upon whoever gives and grants favors. A fleeting and unstable kind of reputation. Well did the man who first said that a democracy is destroyed by the first man who bribes it understand this, namely that the many lose their strength once they become susceptible to receiving gifts. And it is necessary that those who bribe should also think that they are destroying themselves, whenever, by purchasing reputation at great expense, they make the many strong and bold, as though the many were masters able both to give something great and to take it away. Yet this does not mean that one should be stingy in the customary forms of public generosity, since circumstances make it plain that the many hold in greater hatred a rich man who does not share his private wealth than a poor man who steals from the public treasury, regarding the former as arrogance and contempt toward themselves, but the latter as a matter of necessity. Let acts of generosity, then, be, first, given for nothing in return, for in this way they astonish and win over recipients all the more. And next, let them come with a fitting and honorable occasion, one bound up with the honoring of a God that leads everyone toward piety. For at the same time, a strong disposition and belief arises among the many that the divine is great and majestic, whenever they see the men whom they themselves honor and consider great behaving so lavishly and eagerly toward the divine. Just as Plato removed from the young being educated the Lydian and Ionian modes of music, the one because it stirs up the mournful and grieving part of our soul, the other because it fosters what is slippery and unrestrained toward pleasures. So too you should, of the forms of public generosity, most of all drive out of the city whichever one stir up and nourish what is murderous and bestial, or scurrilous and unrestrained. If that is not possible, avoid them and fight hard against the many when they demand such spectacles. Always make the occasions for your expenditures decent and temperate, ones that have as their end what is honorable or necessary, or at least what is pleasant and gratifying without harm or accompanying outrage. And if one's means are modest, circumscribed by a fixed center and radius appropriate to need, there is nothing ignoble or base in openly admitting one's poverty and standing apart from the public generosities of the wealthy, and in not borrowing money, which would be both pitiable and ridiculous, in order to perform public services. For such men do not escape notice as they grow weak or trouble their friends or flatter their creditors, so that they gain from such expenditures neither reputation nor strength, but rather shame and contempt. For this reason, it is always useful, in such matters, to remember Lamachus and Phocion. The latter, when the Athenians asked him at a sacrifice to make a contribution and kept applauding him, said, "I would be ashamed to give to you while not repaying this man, Callicles," pointing to his creditor. Lamachus, for his part, In the accounts of his generalships always entered a charge for money spent on shoes and a cloak for himself. And the Thessalians voted to give Hermann, who was declining office because of poverty, a jar of wine each month and a bushel of barley meal every 4 days. Thus it is no disgrace to admit poverty, nor are poor men left behind, in proportion to their means, by those in cities who hold feasts and finance choruses, provided they have the frankness and trust that come from virtue. In such matters one must above all master oneself, and neither go down onto the plain as a foot soldier to fight against cavalry, nor compete on the racetrack of reputation and power, but always try, relying on virtue and high purpose together with reason, to lead the city men in whom there resides not only what is honorable and dignified, but also what is more desirable than staters of Croesus, gold, something winning and attractive. For the good man is not stubborn or overbearing, nor is the moderate man blunt and abrupt, nor does he walk among the citizens with a look bitter to behold. Rather, he is, first of all, approachable and accessible to all who wish to come near and address him, keeping his house unlocked, like a harbor of refuge, always open to those in need, and displaying his solicitude and kindness not only in matters of need and in actions, but also by grieving with those who stumble and rejoicing with those who succeed. Nowhere burdensome or troublesome with a crowd of servants at the baths or by seizing seats at the theaters, nor conspicuous for the sort of luxury and extravagance that provokes envy, but equal and uniform in dress and manner of life, and in the upbringing of his children and the care of his wife, as one who wishes to live among the people and share their common humanity. Then, by offering himself as a well-disposed counselor and an unpaid advocate and a kindly reconciler between husbands and wives and between friends with one another, spending no small part of the day engaged in public affairs on the platform or in the assembly hall, and then drawing to himself, for the rest of his life, all the other business and household concerns of people, from every side, like clouds driven by the northwest wind, always making himself public property through his cares, and regarding political life as a way of living and acting, not, as most do, as a burden and a public service to be discharged. By all these things and their like, he turns the attention of the many toward himself and draws them in, since they see that the flatteries and lures offered by others are counterfeit and adulterated in comparison with this man's solicitude and good sense. For the flatterers of Demetrius did not deign to address the other kings by the title king, but called Seleucus master of elephants, Lysimachus keeper of the treasury, Ptolemy admiral, and Agathocles lord of the islands. But the many, even if at first they reject the good and sensible man, later, on coming to learn the truth about him and his character, consider this man alone to be truly political, truly a man of the people, and a ruler, while they merely regard and call the others a chorus sponsor, a host, or a gymnasium director. Then, just as at banquets, when Callias or Alcibiades is footing the bill, it is Socrates who is listened to, and it is toward Socrates that everyone looks. So too in healthy cities Ismenias may give and Lyches may host dinners and Nicratus may sponsor choruses. But it is Epaminondas, Aristides, and Lysander who rule, engage in politics, and command armies. Looking to these examples, one must not be humbled or overawed by the reputation that arises among the crowds from theaters, banquet halls, and public burial monuments, regarding it as something that lives only a short time and dissolves together with the gladiators and the stage sets, possessing nothing honorable or dignified. Those experienced in the tending and rearing of bees consider the hive that buzzes loudest and is fullest of commotion to be thriving and healthy. But the man to whom God has given care over the rational and political swarm judges its well-being above all by the calm and gentleness of the people. He will, for the rest, accept and imitate, as far as he is able, the practice of Solon, but he will be at a loss and astonished at what possessed that man to write that a citizen who, in a civic faction, attaches himself to neither side should be disfranchised. For a sick body does not begin its change toward health from the parts that are sick together with it, but rather when the constitution that has grown strong in the healthy parts drives out what is contrary to nature. So too in a people torn by faction, when the strife is not so terrible or fatal, but is one that will eventually cease. What is needed is for the element unaffected and sound to be mixed in abundantly, and to remain and dwell among them. For from it, what is proper to health flows in from those of sound mind, and passes through what is diseased. But cities that have been thrown into disorder throughout are utterly ruined, unless they meet with some external force, and, chastised by their sufferings, are forced into moderation. Yet it is not fitting to sit unmoved and unfeeling amid factional strife, hymning one's own freedom from disturbance and the untroubled, blessed life, taking delight in the affairs of others while remaining indifferent. Rather, one must at this point especially put on the buskin of the Raemenes, associating with both sides and attaching oneself to neither. For you will seem, not by refusing to share in wrongdoing, to be an outsider, but by helping to belong to all. And your not sharing in their misfortune will incur no ill will if you appear to grieve equally with everyone. But the strongest course is to take precautions in advance so that factions never arise at all, and to hold this to be the greatest and finest part of the political art, as it were. For observe that of the greatest goods for cities, peace, freedom, prosperity, abundance of men, and conquered, as regards peace, at least for the present, the people have no need at all of politicians, at the present time, for war, whether Greek or foreign, has fled from us and vanished. But of freedom they have as much as their rulers allot to the people, and perhaps more would not even be better for them. While for abundance of crops, a kindly blending of seasons, and for their wives to bear children like their parents, and for safety for those born to them, the prudent man will pray to the gods on behalf of his own citizens. What remains, then, for the statesman alone, out of the tasks now before him, and it is second to none of these blessings, is to instill concord and friendship always among those who dwell together, and to remove every kind of strife, faction, and ill will, treating the matter as one does in quarrels between friends. First joining company with the side that thinks itself more wronged, sharing its sense of grievance and its indignation, and then setting about to soften and instruct it, explaining that among those who contend to force their will and win, it is those who yield who are superior not only in fairness and character, but also in high-mindedness and greatness of soul, and that by conceding a little they win in the things that are finest and greatest. And further, teaching both individually and collectively, and pointing out the weakness of Greek affairs, of which it is better for sensible men to partake in only one respect, namely to live out their lives in quiet and concord, since fortune has left no prize remaining in the middle to contend for. For what leadership, what glory, is there now for the victors? What power is there, which some trivial edict of a proconsul can dissolve or transfer to another, possessing nothing worth the effort even if it should remain? Since then, just as a conflagration does not often begin from sacred or public places, but some lamp neglected in a house, or some heap of rubbish that has caught fire, sends up a great flame and works public destruction, so too it is not always public rivalries over common affairs that kindle civil strife in a city. Often it is private matters and personal collisions that, having advanced into the public sphere, throw the whole city into confusion. It falls to the statesman, no less than to anyone, to heal these things and to forestall them, so that some may not come into being at all, others may cease quickly, and yet others may not gain magnitude or touch upon public affairs, but remain confined to the very parties in dispute. The statesman himself paying attention and pointing out to others how private matters become the causes of public ones, and small matters of great ones, when overlooked and not given care and consolation at the outset. For instance, at Delphi the greatest revolution is said to have arisen because of Crates. When Orsilaus, son of Phales, was about to marry his daughter, then, the mixing bowl having spontaneously cracked in the middle during the libations, he took it as an omen, left the bride, and departed with his father. But Crates, a little later, when they were offering sacrifice, planted some gold from the sacred treasury on them, and had Orsilaus and his brother hurled from the cliff without trial, and again, put to death some of their friends and relatives who had taken refuge as suppliants in the temple of Athena Prania. After many such deeds had occurred, the Delphians killed Crates and his fellow conspirators, and with the money, the men being called accursed, rebuilt the lower temples. and at Syracuse, of two intimate young men. One, having taken charge of the other's beloved to guard while he was away, corrupted him during his absence. And the other, in turn, as if repaying the outrage, seduced that man's wife. One of the elders, coming before the council, urged that both be driven out, before the city should taste of their enmity and be filled with it. He did not, however, persuade them, and as a result they fell into civil strife, and amid great disasters overturned the finest constitution. And you yourself, I dare say, have examples close to home, the enmity of Pardalis against Tyrrhenus, which came within a little of destroying Sardis, casting it, from small and private causes, into revolt and war. Therefore one must not let the statesman despise such things, just as in the body there are quick spreadings of minor injuries, but must take hold of them, press on them, and give aid. For by attentiveness, as Cato says, even the great is made small, and the small is brought to nothing at all. And there is no greater device toward persuasion in these matters than for a man to offer himself, in private disputes, as a gentle and unresentful mediator, standing by the original causes and adding to no one's contentiousness, nor anger, nor any other passion that produces harshness and bitterness in necessary disputes. Those who wrestle in the palestra bind their hands round with soft gloves, so that their contest may not fall into anything irreparable, the blow being made gentle and painless. But in trials and lawsuits against fellow citizens, it is better to contend using charges that are clean and unadorned, and not, like arrows, to notch and poison one's dealings with slanders, malicious insinuations, and threats, making them irreparable, great, and public matters. For the man who conducts himself this way toward those under him will have the rest as well obedient to him. Whereas rivalries over public affairs, once private hatreds are removed, become slight and bring nothing that is either harsh or irreparable.